And welcome, 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 dear listeners, wherever you find yourself. Welcome to this Friday session specifically of the Holiday Reads here on your number one talk radio station. And obviously, this is the Family Day public holiday that follows on immediately after the Christmas Day itself, that being 25 December and 26 December immediately following on. And obviously, for many particular party animals out there, this obviously is the dream team combination specifically of how public holidays need to flow. And I cannot disagree with you. I mean, it's 3 days of just lounging about, lazying, wherever you find yourself. Obviously, here at Eagle FM, we're obviously working, you know, pretty very hard, specifically in bringing you holiday-based content during the course of the two-week period, 2 week spare change days, specifically of holiday programming. Obviously, trying to also keep you in touch as well as up to date with various developments still happening. Now, interesting things obviously have been popping off internationally, globally. You can always have a look there at our socials, primarily in terms of developments that have taken place. One of the major talking points, obviously, that emanate from one of our social media posts has been the strikes in the northwest region of Nigeria that has been conducted yesterday on the 25th of December by American forces on the behest or technically with the supervision and permission and involvement of Nigerian authorities. So obviously very interesting particular developments happening there during this holiday period. You know, the rest of the world doesn't sleep. But unfortunately, we here in Namibia, we're taking it slow, we're taking it mellow, and we're obviously enjoying our holiday periods wherever we find ourselves. Just once again reiterating, dear listeners, if you're still driving or if you're still traveling, wherever you're traveling from or to, kindly do drive safely. Obviously, we do know that wet weather does create an anomaly in terms of driving conditions for many drivers out there. Obviously, also try to maintain and stay within the speed limits across the country's national road network, thus also ensuring that we don't have to hear about, you know, various particular fatalities that happened due to specifically traffic accidents that would be popping up during this particular jovial period, this particular holiday period, and this particular period of where family and friends get together and just enjoy each other's company. Now, enough of the well-wishing discussion. Obviously, as I mentioned, for the holiday session here, or the holiday session between 5:30 and 7, you're in my company, Dwight, here on Eagle FM, specifically taking a look at holiday reads. For those of you who are avid readers obviously who wish to find new ideas in terms of anything new to peruse and anything new to consume during this particular period, that you've got to be recharging your batteries for the new year, the oncoming 2026. That's obviously less than a week away. Just to be safe with my calculations, I think the 1st of January will be a Thursday, yes. And obviously, it's less than a work week. No, exactly a work week from today, and specifically because the 31st of December is going to be a Wednesday. And for those of you, obviously, that wherever you find yourself, you know, just enjoy your holiday period with great enthusiasm. I actually, you know, give you that full-on blessing. Go crazy if you must, but, you know, stay within limits in that scenario. Now, where we find ourselves here, dear listeners, on this Friday edition, we're obviously going to be taking a very interesting look at, you know, if you are going to be someone who's looking to get involved with some serious reading. And when I say serious reading, I'm actually talking about getting involved with classical titles and classical authors. So what are classical titles and classical authors? These are authors who, unfortunately, lived a couple of hundred years ago. In some cases, 150, in other cases, about 200 years ago. Or in many other cases, if you're someone that started with the Iliad of Homer and the other collection that Homer also wrote, you're obviously, you know, going way back into a different time period itself. And interesting things primarily to look at from is that there's always various ways of, you know, sort of like being transported into someone else's world at a different time frame, in a different period across reading history. Now, I'm not talking about reading the actual subject of history. I'm actually talking about reading historic works, classical works, specifically across human history, wherever you find yourself from various periods and the likes. For example, myself, but even though that was a book based upon strategy and the likes, which was Sun Tzu's The Art of War, I also read the summarized and slightly shortened version of Machiavelli's The Prince. Obviously, in both scenarios, there was very few, and I'm giving you an honest review, very few particular, you know, applications that you could look like, could look at in a real world sense by having to look at the strategies and the particular knowledge that they're dispensing. Obviously, they give insights to their settings, their particular contexts, their particular scenarios, and their particular realities. However, the reality, if you were someone, when did I read The Prince? The Prince was in 2019. So if you're looking at the world or Namibia, according to Dwight, in 2019, it's a stark, you know, major difference from the world of, I mean, what was it? 15 something for The Prince, that Machiavelli wrote. And it's a stark difference from The Art of War that Sun Tzu wrote, which could be anywhere between 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. And I mean, that is two major time periods in human history that just, you know, give completely different directions of what things are like and the realities that exist in today's scenario or today's world versus the scenarios contained within each of those two works. However, they are still interesting reads to read and to peruse and to consume. I mean, I don't want to give too much away about those two particular books because we will be covering them in the coming week, in next week specifically, as they are particular titles that I have gone through. But in today's particular session, we're actually looking at reads that highlight various particular time frames, various particular authors, various particular stories, various particular genres that you can highlight. However, in many cases, they form part of a massive umbrella of classical work. And when I say a massive umbrella of classical work, I'm actually talking about, in that umbrella of classical work, you can put in fiction, you can put in religion, you can put in various particular perspectives of the authors themselves, as well as also taking a look at the impact that some of these particular works have had on the way of thinking at the time. For example, if you were someone that read the very first, okay, not the very first, but let me rather put it like this. If you were someone that read the impact that someone like Jane Austen has had on storytelling from a woman's perspective, specifically storytelling of, the adventures and the particular way of life of a specific period in England. So I'm talking about between the 17 to the 1800s, thereabout. And obviously also looking at how life or what life looked like, you know, back then. Yeah, she was born in 1775 and she died in 1817. So that puts her at what? She was 41 when she passed away. So if you look at the particular time frame in terms of the period of Europe at the time that Jane Austen was writing at, yeah, sure. You get an insight specifically as a reader into that kind of life, into the world that Austen was exposed to. The particular, the development specifically in romance. And just to share a little bit of a nugget of information with you guys. I actually enjoy, the storytelling of Jane Austen. Even though I might not look like a guy or sound like a guy that reads or loves or actually likes watching, you know, romance stories. But I actually like romance stories of a certain period. A period, obviously, where there's actual human interactions, actual human emotions and, you know, things happening in the real life impact the life of, you know, the characters and the story. And that there are real life elements, for example, things of a cultural basis or of a way of life basis that impacts how the characters act. For example, if the particular period that Austin lived in, there was a particular cultural mechanism that the Europeans had at the time. So I know many of you guys here in the Namibian context and in the broader Southern African context, you guys love using the term specifically known as Lobola. But Lobola has a weird situation. Being why I call it weird is that it's a man that is buying a woman, a wife, from her parents. Now, in the modern day economics of things, it doesn't make sense to me specifically, because to me, it just primarily could look like, you know, the parents of the daughter could probably go on the, you know, on a massive auction scenario and then entertain the highest bidder, obviously, for their daughter's hand. But obviously, that's not the scenario that happens. But yeah, you know, that there might be scenarios that happen somewhere where, you know, the parents are actually starting to look like wheelers and dealers specifically in the game of marriage and, you know, and matrimony and all those particular aspects with deciding the futures of their daughters. However, this was an actual thing that happened in Europe, specifically in the era when Jane Austen existed. You know, that from the 1700s into the 1800s. So there was this particular cultural mechanism that occurred. Now, I can't use the label middle class, lower class, upper classes, because according to many economic historians, the term middle class is a relatively new term. Specifically, it only came about supposedly in the last 300 years. Not 300 years. Sorry, that's a little bit long. The last 100 years or so, specifically based upon the developments, you know, of industrial revolutions and the particular earnings that people were starting to make and the particular services that they could start enjoying. So it is considered that the phrase or the origin of the middle class was something that was identified by a man by the name of James Bradshaw in 1745. So you could say probably by the past 250 years, spare change. So I am right by saying 300 years. So the past 250 years. So in that period, probably when Jane Austen was alive, the idea of a middle class setting was probably starting to take shape and form shape, you know, in all that. However, there were still developments happening. Now, the actual explanation, the point that I'm trying to highlight to you, or that I am going to highlight to you, not trying, is that there was this thing known as, what do they call it? Dowry. Yes. Its name was a dowry. So a dowry was actually something that worked in reverse versus the Lobola explanation that you find here in Southern Africa. So a dowry was a payment that was given by the parents of the woman to the potential husband. And that was a scenario that happened in the British context. I don't know about the broader European context. So a dowry was a payment such as land, property, money, livestock, or commercial assets that is paid by the bride's family to the groom or his family at the time of marriage. Dowry contrasts were obviously with related of, you know, the bride price and the dower, obviously, that was being looked at. Now, in many particular cases, how the situation worked was, in the European context, the families knew that if you had men in your family, they were the ones that could join the navy, could start companies, could own land, inheritances would work in a scenario in terms of that only the eldest son could inherit from the father or the parents and stuff like that. So inheritances were basically arranged around the paternal setting. No, not paternal. Paternal implies parents. The paternal set or the male family setting of the family. And if you had daughters, it was viewed more of an inconvenience because you, the father of those daughters, had to pay men to marry your daughter. That's technically what a dowry explains. Now, in a modern day context, you probably would still find some fathers who would think that way, specifically in terms of, you know, that they, you know, that there's no male heir that can carry on with a family name, situations like that, you know, that you would find across the world. And that is something that men think about. That's not something that men cannot ignore. They do think that way. So in the context of Jane Austen, it was always interesting and fascinating to see a love story pop up specifically, or a romance story. I know. It's not a subject matter that I talk about every day, but I love period dramas. I really love period dramas. And they actually, there's a lot of good acting that takes place there. Specifically if I watch it on TV. Or if I read about it specifically. And obviously one of the classics that has ever been written was Jane Austen's, The Pride and Prejudice. And if you've ever watched the movie where it stars, what's his name? James McAvoy, also one of my favorite actors, is that, James McAvoy is the son. He's a son of, okay, let me explain it like this. His uncle brings him to London or to England from Ireland during the 1700s, that period just before England declares war on Napoleon and the French Empire that Napoleon wants to start. And his uncle is actually a local magistrate judge. And James McAvoy's sort of like his character's heritage is one based off a Irish-English background. And McAvoy is brought to England. McAvoy, and at that stage, they had this scenario of, if you think about school, university, and all those things, they had this particular weird way of connecting you to, you know, a future like having a job or a specific role in society that actually you're going to make money from. And one of that was, McAvoy was brought to London specifically to do a specific function, and said particular function was that it helps him sort of like with career growth and be able to find his some sort of calling in terms of the kind of job he will do. And then he starts his life from there because his uncle is there to help him. So obviously it sounds like pure and utter nepotism. I know. The world is unfortunately drenched in nepotism wherever you look. But that was the period back then. And obviously, McAvoy's character meets Keira Knightley's character at a specific function. They had this funny way of having parties, and then people bring the, you know, every who's who come together at a party and or get invited to a party, and people introduce each other, and then, you know, voila, sparks happen, situations happen, and things happen. Today, we've obviously got smartphones and technology to connect with. Now, highlighting some of those particular talking points, obviously, I went a very long way to explain a movie to you that is based off a book that is always cited as a classical read to start from. But we will be going through a major, major sort of like review of classical titles that you can tap into as someone looking for a read during your holiday period. And these are particular titles, dear listeners, that you will find in any bookstore, whether online or in physical copy. You can find them anywhere, and they will still deliver in terms of inspiration, exciting reads. You just sometimes have to be patient, because sometimes I've been explained that certain readers or certain authors had to work tirelessly to explain something to readers back then because they didn't have things known as TVs or cameras or internet and communication technology and media that could take a photo, show you a place in a different part of the world that you've never seen or experienced before. And now they've, in that time, they had to explain things to you. Versus today, you can assume that the picture exists, and this is the particular picture. But on that note, dear listeners, we'll quickly take a short break, and we come back right after this. Ongudiva Achievers Private Center, where the 2026 applications are now open. Boost your grade 11 NSSCO results. We are designed to help learners obtain better grade 11 NSSCO results, intensive practical and teacher-led sessions, and affordable fees with flexible payment options. Subjects that are offered: English as a second language, Oshindonga, biology, chemistry, physics, mathematics, development studies, agricultural science, geography, history, economics, business studies, entrepreneurship, and accounting. How to apply: complete the application and pay the application fee, which is just $150 Namibian. Email the application to Ongudiva Achievers Private Center at wu.edu.na. Alternatively, send your application via WhatsApp to +264 81651 5138. For more information, call Mr. Natangwe at cell number +264 81651 5138. Ongudiva Achievers Private Center, empowering minds, shaping futures. So coming back from that particular short ad break, dear listeners, obviously starting off with the two interesting things to highlight there. There is another interesting part. So in many cases, I always give you a heads up in terms of having to look when you approach certain particular books and titles. You've got to understand what you're going to approach. Some of these classical reads will extend even into our discussions into next week. I'll actually share some of the my personal reading lists, specifically things that I've already read and some that I'm currently reading and some that I'm going to read, because my book reading list is monumental. It's, and I'm even planning on procuring or buying a new book either tomorrow or on Sunday. Obviously just, you know, looking at time scheduling and how that obviously plays out. And it's a book, I don't know if I should buy the one about Southern African prehistoric peoples or the one based upon Namibian history, but we'll get to that particular context and subject matter as well. I love, I've now also somehow, you know, altered my particular perspective in terms of looking at knowledge and history that we did not know of in Namibia, and specifically about conversations and talking points that have been ignored, that have not been looked at, have been researched by other people from other parts of the world. For example, one of these titles that I wish to procure, one of these books that I wish to procure, is a book researched, written, and compiled by he's a Namibian colonial historian. Okay, he's not Namibian. He's actually, you know, someone that likes Namibia a lot. And the particular book itself is printed and published somewhere over there, and somehow it gets promoted in Namibia. Same to also by another, the first book I'm talking about is actually about a German author, a German-Austrian. Somehow I have a sneaky suspicion he's more German than Austrian. And then there is a Japanese author that has also detailed and researched prehistoric cultures in Namibia, specifically, you know, looking at Namibia and, you know, highlighted that particular, I also have that particular book by that author, that Japanese author, but the book was printed in Japan and it was the intellectual properties owned in Japan, just like the intellectual property of the first author I spoke about is owned in Europe. And then there's another book about Namibian brewing history and specifically how colonial, you know, colonial legislation has impeded local, you know, various particular indigenous communities in Namibia from being able to continue with their brewing practices. And that was researched in Namibia, but printed in Europe. I think Switzerland or Austria, one of the two countries, depending on where the publishing company is based. So, yeah, as you can see, and there's obviously a whole bunch of South African work that I also still have to read through. So, yeah, my reading list is pretty fat, pretty big. It's lovely. I like it. But you know what? It's a daunting challenge. And obviously, you know, I'll combat that particular reading challenge as it comes head on, title by title. So where we left off primarily just before my digression there, particularly about my reading list that is building up title by title nonetheless. But still, I will not, you know, I never say no to a challenge or challenge in that matter, is that we're obviously the aspect of classical authors is that they introduce you to their worlds during their time frame through their eyes at a specific point in human history. Now, nothing is more eye-opening than delving into these particular worlds set out by these classical authors that have laid the foundations of reading and opening up new worlds to various generations across time and place. Let me say that again. Through time and place. Now, authors like Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, Mark Twain, and even William Shakespeare. Yes, boring old William Shakespeare. Guys, go read a Shakespeare play. Because obviously, he's the guy that redefined the whole English language that we speak, and specifically redefined the way that acting and, you know, delivering some sort of public entertainment mechanism occurred. Well, obviously, at the period that he had actors, the unfortunate thing is that women were not allowed to act. So even the female characters, the women's characters in Shakespeare's plays were all portrayed by men. So meaning it was male actors playing female characters. So if you ever thought about Hamlet, and you imagined now seeing the Prince Hamlet himself with his depression, with his, you know, mental instability or his mental fortitude just collapsing because of the death of his father, and he can clearly see the schemes of his uncle. Yes, I read Hamlet. I read a book on Hamlet. I read the play Hamlet. I had to study Hamlet. But yeah, Hamlet. Yeah, it was a whole mental case on itself, by itself. And Hamlet's uncle, which is his father's younger brother, is, you know, trying to, you know, woo his mother, who is the queen of Denmark. And Hamlet does not like this, because Hamlet obviously knows what happens in the context of a European monarchy. Was it in the 15 or 1400s? Obviously, you know, yeah. Accidents happen. Things look bad. So even then, even through the work of William Shakespeare, you would be able to understand what the classical world looked like. It actually is a transportation mechanism. And it literally has a time capsule element to it, meaning a time traveling element to it. So as you will be looking through these particular authors and their particular works that introduce you to their worlds they have described and the illustrations for so many that they've, you know, been able to do throughout history and reading history. This particular scenario obviously helps to just introduce you to some of these titles and their particular stories. Now, in many cases, people would say these are must-haves. You must read. It's not always compulsory that you've got to turn to the classics. But in many particular formative reading years, so I'm talking from your 15 to 17 to 16 year old scenarios, it's usually advised that you start reading the classics before you get into the contemporary titles, meaning you start chasing new titles by new authors or modern day authors who are trying to help, you know, they try to push you their idea of science fiction and stuff like that. And yeah, there's nothing wrong with trying to buy into, for example, the Lord of the Rings franchise and, you know, by J.R.R. Tolkien and all the works that Tolkien has done, or even the likes of George R.R. Martin. Yeah, go for it, you know, go read their works if you're someone that loves those particular themes and those particular genres. However, authors in their books contain a lot more not so PG-friendly content than you would expect. So, if you're a reader and if you're a teenager and if you're a young reader or you're someone in your 20s already, I'll just tell you now. I'll just give you a heads up. Some authors, I mean, that's one of the reasons why there was a famous list of banned books, but we'll do that next week. The famous list of banned books. I've spoken about it before on Eagle FM. But we'll do the famous list of banned books again for the holiday period, because there's nothing wrong with these books. The reasons why they were banned was because at that stage they were thought provoking and they were pushing the boundaries on certain subject matters at that time when the book was first printed back then. Today, I mean, my goodness, so many things have progressed specifically in the modern day context that, you know, the ideas that the books would be talking about is nothing novel. It's nothing new. It's nothing. It's, you know, it doesn't push any more boundaries anymore. These things are happening today. So first and foremost, obviously, I started with the Jane Austen title, but in many cases, when you've got to look at the classics, the idea is always you start from somewhere. In many cases, and yes, we've got to genderize our particular take for today as well. Many women do start with a Jane Austen. They do. I'm not even going to sugarcoat the scenario, but many women start with Jane Austen. And they specifically start with Pride and Prejudice. You know, the idea of a Prince Charming, the idea of, you know, romance and the likes. Jane Austen wrote some pretty good stuff. There is another author that I never read. I don't think probably I might have time to still read that guy. Because obviously I keep going down a specific period or specific time frame or specific genre that I pursue and collect books on. But for Jane Austen specifically, you can look at things like having a position of, you know, what life is like in that particular period, which also has you asking that particular question when you're reading the book. You could have a decent insight into what life was like back then for people, young people, parents and the likes, you know, and the context under which people lived back then, as well as also trying to understand, you know, how people acted when they were interested in each other, you know. Was it the modern way of dating today, or was it, you know, what was things like back then? There's actually also a very nice story that I got from, what was the guy's name? Okay, I won't mention his name because, yeah, there are certain developments happening where he's currently working. But yeah, he was my former sort of like general manager and explained in my previous career path and explained to me a very wonderful sort of like, you know, romantic setting. And I was really surprised, you know, because usually I don't, you know, accountants, people who study accountant are not really romantic people that you would ever encounter. But actually, that day he impressed me. Was like, hey, look at this guy. You know, he's actually a romantic guy. And he explained, you know, how does sort of like affection and love work between, you know, two people who are interested. You know, the man has to write a little bit of a letter to the woman, and he sends, and you know, correspondence firstly takes place like that. And I was like, what kind of 90s high school situation is this? Who still does this? You walk up to the woman today and you could tell her, hey, I like you or I don't like you. Or she responds probably with, I like you, or she says, I don't like you. Yeah, situations like that. So, the nice thing is sometimes to see in romance novels like Pride and Prejudice written by Jane Austen. It came out in 1813, its first edition. Can you believe it? 200 years later, it's still running strong. Specifically in that context, 200 and something plus years, 28 or something years. So, if you are a first, you know, you're, you're a young reader, you're in your teenage years specifically, or a young, you know, in your 20s, and you'd like to bump up your reading, you know, caliber and capabilities, Pride and Prejudice always features top for many female readers. There's nothing wrong with us guys reading a little bit of romance. Come on, guys. Sometimes we also just have to step up our game, even though it might be looking back in history. Another title that comes up, and this is an American title, by an American author. Harper Lee is the author's name, and the book's name is To Kill a Mockingbird, which came out in 1960. But the famous thing about the book is that there was a movie made about the book. So To Kill a Mockingbird is actually a setting in terms of where it takes place in a contemporary context of the period that the author sets it at. But it's a classic in the sense that it speaks of a coming of age period that obviously explores various particular themes in a small town in the southern states of America. And it obviously has to do with some of the particular characters and how they go about these various subjects and themes based in this book. Now, this is obviously as the character, which is a lawyer, advises his children on various real world developments that take place. And at that specific stage, it was in the 60s in the United States, in the South of America. It was usually that the main theme there was based upon the lines of, sort of like the interactions between the various ethnicities in the United States. And the theme obviously is that you've got to look at this in terms of what things looked like back then in the 60s. Now, we always hear about the particular developments and the particular tribulations that Martin Luther King, the Reverend, just to think that that guy, he was already so advanced specifically in his ability to become a freedom fighter, and he was 31 when he died. Already so advanced, and the ideas and the things that he was talking about. And you can obviously see in terms of the caliber or the way he was thinking, meaning obviously speaking about his upbringing and the education that was present then versus what we see today. Yeah, I mean, it's a stark difference, which is also an interesting thing because there's a whole bunch of videos there on YouTube about what children were thinking about. Or they were asked questions, specifically in the UK, what life would be like in the 2000s. And these were children that were asked questions in the 60s and in the 70s. And these kids were articulate. I mean, they're like 8 years old, 9 years old. And they already had like advanced thinking capabilities. The subjects that the level of thinking that they could look forward to, you would be just impressed. So, which also brings us in terms of looking at how certain books were written at the time. Exposing, putting a little bit of a spotlight on certain subject matter of that time, which is subject matter which you can still see today. But in today's context, obviously, there is now much exposure about this particular subject matter. What is the subject matter? Primarily based around racism. And yes, even though I used the term ethnic groups back then, but obviously in the context of To Kill a Mockingbird, it's technically two groups that you have to look at, the particular experiences and so forth and so forth. Now, when I mentioned the movie that was made about it, it starred Jack Nicholson. He's the famous scene in that movie where there's a hole it's a specific, you know, where Jack Nicholson's face has like a little bit of a crazy look on it, and he, you know, sticks his face out, and he has this particular sort of like malicious expression on his face. I call it malicious because if you try to interpret the facial expression, you don't know if he's happy or he's happy to cause some harm, or he's actually angry, or there's any particular malice in that expression itself, because it's just an expression. It's just a facial expression. But that scene from the movie by the same name, To Kill a Mockingbird, it's famous because it's used in memes. It's used everywhere. You'll find it everywhere. But I mean, the internet is now, you know, sort of like omnipresent almost everywhere that you can access it. So the interesting thing is, if you ever find a copy of the, of this book, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee across any of the bookshops that you encounter throughout Namibia, well, according to the list that I've got here in front of me, it would be one of those particular classics that you can tap into and have a look at. Obviously, it'll actually expose you to the themes of the 1960s, which is not so far back. I mean, it's 60 years in that direction, or is it? Yeah, it's 60 years or 70. No, it's 60 years in that direction. Yeah, and there's still a lot of Namibians that were born in the 60s that you can always, if you know a few, yeah, talk to them. They would usually be considered the boomers. There's a lot of running jokes about the boomers, but yeah. So that would obviously be one of the, that would be number two on the particular, you know, talking point of trying to tap into classical books or classical reads. The next particular book or title is actually something that Leonardo DiCaprio made famous. Well, actually, let me stop that statement right there. Let me correct that statement that I just made there. Actually, the book was already famous before Leonardo DiCaprio starred in a movie by the same name. Now, I never watched the movie, just to let you know. But according to those that have watched it, it's actually to use Helmut and former President Mbumba's favorite word, it is top-notch. You know, it's a top-notch title itself, specifically to, you know, the movie to watch. But when you go and read the book, you will not be disappointed. Why? It's the story that we all see. It's the story that we potentially have seen in our own lives. Rags to riches. You fall in love with a girl from the other side of the tracks, from the other side of town, who you know she's out of your league. You know, and I'm talking about us guys, because that's the storyline that always runs through our minds, because we always fantasize about these, but because you see the storyline a lot. But I mean, I'm even watching a TV series currently that follows the same storyline. It's the Robin Hood production by MGM, Metro Goldwyn and Mayer, which technically has that theme of Robin Hood, meaning Robert of Locksley, falling in love with Marion Huntington, who later on becomes Maid Marian. I know a lot of the other particular storylines because I've read a lot and watched a lot of TV. But yeah, so we always have these particular themes. Now, during the 1920s to 1930s, let's actually put it a little bit earlier. Let's say from the First World, just after the First World War ended, into the booming 20s, as they call it, which is the period that preceded the Great Depression. You guys need to read up about this, specifically about similarities that people put with regards to whether or not the global financial sector, specifically from the American financial market, whether they learned any lessons from the Great Depression of the 1930s, because so many economic historians are pointing towards how actually the Great Depression is what led to the Second World War. And even if you go and Google search the description and you ask this question in the Google search bar, what caused the Second World War? The answers that you will get is literally saying it's because Japan invaded Manchuria in China, which is a partial response. Just like if you ask the question specifically, why did Japan invade Manchuria? And then you'll be given a whole bunch of sort of like economic reasons. Yeah, because Japan needed iron ore, Japan needed coal, Japan needed this, Japan needed that. They went on this sort of like colonialism or colonization trend to, you know, secure resources for their industrial complex. But you will still come back to the same particular point, because the questions of why will just keep on multiplying. You'll ask yourself, but why did Japan have to do this? And then you're going to ask yourself, and one of the questions will always be, was Japan always a bad guy? And then you'll sit with the opposite of that response. No, the Japanese wanted to work closely with the British, with the Americans, and with the French,
who were all colonial powers, except for the Americans. But yeah, okay. Puerto Rico and Cuba, you know, and Haiti. Yeah, okay. Let's put all of them still in that cluster. So you'll be asking yourself, these sort of like, these, and you'll see a lovely demonstration of all that economic history channeling through this movie, The Great Gatsby. Obviously, that's now if you watch the movie. If you read the book, it's obviously a different thing. Now, I have to give you sort of like, what do they call that? A bit of a disclaimer on this book. Okay, not on this book particularly, but when you look at the period back then. During the 1920s, dear listeners, if you guys did not know, there was actually a lot of liberalism that existed back then. You know, sort of like bouncing back after what was considered the war to end all wars, the First World War. And there were a whole bunch of Namibians during that particular period that had fought in that war as well. They were obviously recruited through the South African army that was present obviously at that stage that had gotten control or that had advanced into Namibia. Just like I had shared specifically on the My Sunday Morning Take when we looked at the unknown African First World War history specifically that took place here in Namibia. Based on the history that I bumped into in Tumip, or between Tumip and Grootfontein and the Lake Oshikoto and Otavi, all these particular historic sites that are there, it's history that we don't know of in Namibia. It's history that's front and central into the affairs of what led to South Africa actually taking, you know, having Namibia as a possession, to what literally led to developments in terms of the establishment of the League of Nations, the establishment of the United Nations after the Second World War, all those things. It was precursor events. You can go from micro to macro, micro to macro, continuously to see the particular relationship that Namibia today has with number one, South Africa, number two, with Germany and the European Union collectively. So, bringing you back to The Great Gatsby. But before we actually do that, dear listeners, we're really going to take a short break and come back right after this.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of
its Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nenge no wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondu tuto ingida, ashike kapeno nweku tite opoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo, iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM, otuna evi tota enjuka, okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune uto, otukwetira o special ange, tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka, opone ushendi fenawa, nokumona oijamo ili nawa, ninge kwata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM, onora etatu imwe bali heali, nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa, nora etatu natu, bali o etatu watatu, omafilane Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Now coming back, dear listeners, and obviously getting us back where we left off with our discussion. Just before the extended break right there was, when you've got to look at The Great Gatsby, it is ultimately also a love story situation. If you've watched the movie, you would know what the book is technically about. But always, as I say, which is a mantra I have come to learn through experience, the book's always better than the movies. Yeah, the movies are all show. They overpay the actor for said particular presentation and illustration. And obviously, the movie companies make a ton of money. So do also the rights holders to the books, that obviously allow for these productions, these reproductions of their work. But at the heart of it, the discussion is that the books are just better than the movies, because the books help to describe the situation, the setting, the characters, the acting, the interactions, the society at the time, the economics at the time, the influences on behavior and the kinds of situations. And yes, someone that divorces themselves from a storyline will ultimately explain to you that yes, even though in most books, it's a situation of a linear storytelling, meaning it actually follows a linear path. And it's highly controlled. And if you've ever played a video game of linear storytelling, it's just one line. You can't deviate from it. You just channel through this line. It's literally a line that you have to follow. So linear storytelling is obviously present everywhere. Even though in some video game situations, they try to tell you, yeah, there's a sandbox, open world experiences and likes that. But the storyline is linear. The storyline is always linear. So, even in a book sense, in storytelling, in books, yes, in the classics, things are linear. The world is pretty narrow and you have to focus with with a magnifying glass. You'll have to use a magnifying glass to concentrate on the subject matter and on the characters. Now, this obviously introduces you to interesting particular reads, because this is about the American dream at that stage, as they call it. What the American dream is like, because I've been watching a few sort of like podcasts on YouTube about, is it still possible for, even Americans themselves to achieve the American dream? And it seems like more that the American dream is more like becoming a tech bro and, flaunting ridiculous amounts of money everywhere you go. But yeah, a great read, The Great Gatsby itself. It introduces you into a setting in the world that has rich economic history about, specifically. Go read up about the Great Depression. Go and understand about the, as they call it, the Roaring Twenties. They call that period of the 1920s, between 1920 and 1929 or 1930 specifically, the Roaring Twenties, because there was apparently so much money going around in the American financial markets and the stock markets, and everyone had wanted to be an industrialist here, industrialist there, and then just the story of protectionism started popping up and things just went just south from there, specifically from 1929, 1930 into the 1930s, which caused literally the Great Depression, which impacted the German farmers, impacted the German industrial complex, impacted most much of the ability of a Germany that was trying to rebuild itself after the First World War, and all the compensation it had to pay France and Britain and surrounding European nations, specifically for the inconvenience of the First World War, which obviously gives rise to the political developments of the failed Austrian painter in the in the German political landscape. And so, yeah, the rest is history from there. And specifically, that's where we find ourselves in 2025, specifically. Getting into a context, obviously, of a story that I tried watching. I mean, it didn't fit with me specifically because the whole thing was had an English over, sort of like a voiceover. If you don't know what a voiceover is, for those of you guys that love watching telenovelas, specifically, doesn't matter if it's the local broadcasting network or on the paid pay-per-view TV service here in Namibia or wherever, a voiceover is when you can actually see that the thing was produced in Spanish or in a different language, but there's no way for you to change it, you know, on the device to the original dialogue option and language option. Because you'd rather like to hear the language and then read the subtitles of in English, you know, to translate it. But the Netflix TV series of this particular book, known as 100 Years of Solitude, which is actually a tragedy. The book is actually a tragedy. Little bit of tragedy. It has a theme of what we've got here, even in Southern Africa, you know, that theme of witchcraft and sorcery that we sometimes run around here in Africa, even in Namibia, that we think we have, you know, I'll leave those subject matters just like that. So, this book, known as 100 Years of Solitude, written by the author Gabriel Garcia Marquez, which came out in 1967, is actually also a book that gives you a deep dive into a South American culture. But it's one part of South America, not the entire South America, because it's obviously from a Spanish-speaking scenario. But before we continue, dear listeners, we'll actually take a short break and come back right after this.
Get extra big savings for an extra special Christmas at WB. Like 2 liter Oros, now only $37.99. 750 gram Crossen Blackwell Mayo for $37.99. 10 kg Buck Pro Fat Cook Flour for $139.99. And 2 kg Surf Hand Wash Powder for only $48.99. See all our December specials online at vurmanbrock.com. We care.
Coming back to listeners from the short break right there and heading into the last third of today's particular program here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. This is the Holiday Reads with me, Dwight. You're in my company from 5:30 up until 7 p.m. And obviously where we left off was taking a look at the next particular title known as the 100 Years of Solitude title written by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Its first edition came out in 1967. But this is actually a book that takes you across a multi-generational, time traveling situation. So you get to look into a discussion of potentially how decisions by a great grandfather over there impacts the descendant of that person today in this time frame. Obviously, it is based on in a time frame a little bit earlier, but it has its ups, it has its downs, it has funny parts, meaning comedy at one stage, and it has some really sad parts. That's hence the ups and the downs, indication right there. This is also a book specifically or title that has you reflecting on, things that were and things that are. Things that made you happy and things that made you sad situations. I mean, some of the best movies that I've sometimes watched, come from, you know, that were these, the English speaking market calls it international movies, but it's, you know, just foreign language movies, movies that come out of, from other countries like Japan, like South America, like Brazil, which is in South America, like in other parts of Europe, French or France or, Italy for that matter. And then you find out the stories in those movies specifically are productions of books of their authors from their own home markets. For example, one of the authors that I spoke about yesterday in the edition of the Holiday Reads about, you know, short story compilations is an author by the name of Haruki Murakami, who wrote a book by the name of Norwegian Wood. It has nothing to do with Norwegian forests, nothing, absolutely. Sometimes just the naming of the title is a little bit obscure and stuff like that. But Norwegian Wood is actually a very sad love story. It's a romance between two young people in their 20s, specifically a guy and a woman. But the woman has some sort of a mental disability or mental condition. And this book takes place in the 70s in Japan or in Tokyo. And she has to be institutionalized, the young woman. And the guy knows that the moment she gets institutionalized, there's no way she will ever come out again. And, you know, it has this somber element to it. But the first half of that movie, which gives an indication of, because in many cases, the other markets, they actually follow the book page by page, sequence by sequence, scene by scene, you know, chapter by chapter. As opposed to what, for example, the worst thing I've ever seen Hollywood do. If you guys have ever read, I almost said Stieg Larsson. But yeah, but the guy's name is Stieg Larsson. Many of the female readers, in Namibia would know of this writer and of the books, because the first book's name is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And obviously, the particular title or the particular title of the book by Stieg Larsson is that this is like a thriller, action, suspense novel about this female hacker who is somehow embroiled into a larger plot of you know, that's developing, and you know, just things that she's trying to sort out. And as you go through the books, so the first one is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The second one is The Girl That Kicked the Hornet's Nest. And the last one is The Girl That Played with Fire. The Girl That Played with Fire, is literally where you find out that the reason why the girl, in the main protagonist, the main character in the story, why she was an orphan, why she was given up to the orphanage or the orphan agency in Sweden, is primarily because her father was some sort of an international spy. And her father was doing weird things. So she needed to be protected by the social services of Sweden. And that's the reason why she ended up the way she is. And then you see this big sort of like plot come together, developed by the author Stieg Larsson. And you're like, this is a very good book. Or these were very good books with a very good storyline. Having captured you as an author and has transported you into this fictional setting of suspense, of thrilling action, as well as also in some cases some violence. But yeah. And then you sit there and you're, but this is a good thing. And then you go watch the movies that the Swedes make, the Swedish editions of the movies, the three books, their three movies. Each of those movies are more than 2 hours long. And then Hollywood shows up with that thing that they had Daniel Craig play the main character in. And I was like, but why is Daniel Craig the main character? Daniel Craig's character was never supposed to be the main character. He is a bit part character. He's like a backup singer, you know, situation there. He's not supposed to be the Beyonce. He's supposed to be a backup singer. But no, Hollywood does that and then. And I watched the Hollywood edition after watching the three movies based upon the three books. Each movie following each book. I was so disappointed. Hollywood literally just flushed money down the toilet with that movie. And I could never understand why they made something like that. Which is also the same funny thing, because Hollywood then also tried to go and make a Russian classic movie known as Anna Karenina. I've spoken about this as well. And the interesting thing was when Keira Knightley and what was the actor? Aaron. Okay. But he was the guy that played in in that weird superhero movie, which is not actually a superhero movie because it's a vigilante movie. I can't say it on air because one of the words is actually a foul word or a vulgar word. But yeah, so if you don't know what Anna Karenina is, it takes place in 1800s Russia, Imperial Russia, and specifically that the woman Anna Karenina, she's the wife of a Russian nobleman, and she falls in love with a young cavalry officer from the Russian Imperial Army. And obviously, as you know how things go there, it sounds very similar to a Jane Austen situation. People start flirting with each other and things pop off. And then you get traveled in, you get placed as a reader within the cultural setting that happened back then during Imperial Russia of how, you know, romance, specifically forbidden romance is treated. And specifically that the main character, this woman, you know, it is discovered that she has this clandestine affair with, this cavalry or this military officer, even though she is a woman of a pretty high standing in Russian society back then. And things just, you know, they just flow from there, and you get immersed in this discussion. Now, the funny thing was that Hollywood came and asked, you know, with some of the Russian service providers that they worked with there on the production of that movie, because they flew to Russia to go and produce the movie there with this English cast and this British cast, and everyone was speaking, and they were asking the Russians, you know, so what did you guys think about the production? And the Russians went like, yeah, we make like every year an Anna Karenina version. And it was just complete sort of like, you know, like, ah, you know what, guys, it's our story. We know how the story is told. So yeah, there's nothing you can tell us about our story. So yeah. And the nice thing is, bringing you back from that digression as well to the story of 100 Years of Solitude. If you are going to watch the Netflix production, please know it is voiced over. You won't be able to tap into the subtitles or try to listen to the original Spanish dialogue and then read subtitles, because Netflix released it to the English market with just that voiceover, which makes it feel like a telenovela, which makes it feel not genuine. The storytelling is not pure. It's not raw. It's not there. However, you can always turn to the book. The book is always there. And if you ever bump into the book in any of the bookstores across Namibia, do understand, it will sort of like take you in an Alice in Wonderland setting. What do I mean by that? You will be literally traveled through the generations that are contained within this book, but you will enjoy it. You will enjoy it. Even though I did not enjoy the TV show, at least, of that is based upon the book. This book came out in 1967, just to let you know, but it actually gives you a deep dive into some parts of South American culture, and you'll be able to enjoy it. Now, getting into a sort of like, another particular, if I can call it like a American classic, because it is considered an American classic, is, and there was a movie made by this author. I don't know why Hollywood went and made a movie, but yeah, I mean, they made a movie of the guy. The author's name is Truman Capote. Truman Capote himself, obviously, he was hailed as some sort of a shining beacon of, you know, new thought during the 60s and the 70s of the US. He wrote a book by the name of In Cold Blood in 1960, that came out in 1965. It was considered a groundbreaking novel, because Capote, supposedly, spent 6 years researching for this book. And he created a new genre known as the non-fiction novel, meaning he obviously applied certain particular things in it. And it also helped to create a new school of journalism and invented the true crime genre as we know it. Because if you don't know what true crime is, my sister, that's actually an avid reader of the true crime genre, has read things. For example, there's a famous farm murder case that took place in South Africa, here in the North Cape of South Africa, of a young boy who, and it, the book was compiled by a journalist that worked on the story, from Pretoria. True crime situation. The only surviving victim of a farm attack was the son of this household, but his father, his mother, and his sister, were the supposed victims of this attack, and he blamed it upon, you know, some sort of robber murderous situation of people attacking the farm and then just, you know, leaving him supposedly alive as the only survivor. So that is the kind of genre specifically that Capote had reinvented in the 60s. And you've got to understand, dear listeners, many particular things are happening specifically during everyday life. And obviously, in some cases, for example, there was even a lot of journalists in North America, based upon certain developments from Donald Trump's first term as president, just before up to the COVID pandemic period, that brought out a couple of books about certain particular chapters of how things had transpired during that first term. So you get to understand why Truman Capote is hailed as this new, he's actually the founder of this new genre in literature across the world, known as true crime. And you will find a lot of them producing all these particular developments across the world. Getting into our next particular title, this is one that it is supposedly a, if I can call it like a, it subscribes to supposedly a different classical author. If you've ever seen if you ever read a book of Charlotte Bronte, specifically the most famous title of Charlotte Bronte is known as Jane Eyre, or Jane Eyre, as some people pronounce it. Jean Rhys, brought out a book by the name of The Wide Sargasso Sea, published in 1966. It obviously is a book that explores the feminist genre and also the anti-colonial subject matter. And this obviously takes a look specifically of, the various characters portrayed in this story and how they interact with each other. Now, this is obviously based around the events of a Mr. Rochester's disastrous marriage to a one Antoinette Conway, or sometimes known in the book as Bertha, or Berta, like we sometimes like to say, but, you know, in terms of pronunciation, her Bertha. And the particular conversation obviously here is that it's a classical novel that puts you in a, sort of like a, once again, pre-first industrial revolution setting, meaning a couple of hundred years that direction. And you've got to look at how, you know, people during that particular time handled, free-spirited persons, or people that were trying to have just a little bit more liberties and personal rights in terms of decision-making and the like. And we've also got to recognize certain particular things, guys. For example, like that Jane Austen title that I started off from, the Pride and Prejudice, which is a known classical springboard to start from, is that you still see some of those particular real-life situations here, even in Namibia, like I mentioned, like with the Lobola situation. But obviously, with a dowry back then, it was sort of like dowries existed because it seemed like households considered daughters to be burdens, meaning the father had to pay a man to marry his daughter, meaning to marry the daughter out of the household. So yeah, you get certain situations like that. Obviously, in a modern day context like that, which man would not say yes to being paid to marry someone's daughter? I do think many guys would spring forward. In many other considerations, many guys would not want to pay a lot of men
to marry their daughters because, you know, knowing how, you know, if guys that are fathers of daughters, they don't even want to think in that direction. In many cases, there's actually a lot of fathers-in-law that don't like their sons-in-law, primarily because, you know, they don't trust the treatment, that whether or not the guy can actually live up to the set particular conditions of treating their daughters well. But yeah, I mean, that's just the modern day world we live in. Now, you can look at the White Sargasso Sea in the same particular setting as just like the Jane Austen title of Pride and Prejudice. It obviously takes you back to a certain period, but it obviously has certain quirks and certain dimensions in it that makes it way more different than that of the Jane Austen offering. Heading into another particular title that you can also look at to help you sort of like get into a holiday reading from a classical perspective. Introducing sort of like, if you can think about it, let's call it like some of the early pioneers of the genre of something AI, something scientific-ish. Science fiction-ish. The book by the name of The Brave New World by Aldous Huxley came out in 1932, the very first edition. It obviously looks at a world in terms of, you know, introducing the very first thing about robotics and AI, the suggestion of the subject matter of AI or machine learning. This obviously is that, you know, it's a very rudimentary insight that you get in terms of how people back then thought what a modern day world that would have a highly technology-drenched society would look like. And obviously questions in terms that would, you know, that are being emitted by this, not omitted, emitted, you know, an emission that would be emitted by this particular book in terms of thinking about, you know, what happens if everything is left up to machines, and if machines ran the world, you know, what would the future look like in that consideration? Which is not far off, I mean, because it is something that Sam Altman had researched, which is one of the talking points that Helmut and I explored back in 2024, specifically about, you know, what the AI guys are looking at, and many people were saying, no, it's not, you know, that's not really what will happen. But if you ask the question specifically, if you're gonna replace a whole bunch of people from doing specific jobs, these jobs actually help to feed and to look after certain particular people in societies. How are you going to look after these people that would not have these jobs anymore? And how would you actually migrate people into new roles? Because that's the thing that the first industrial revolution did, was firstly try to migrate a economy from a agrarian function, which is Namibia's particular scenario. Agrarian and very basic and stuck in a primary sector function, into the advancements or the progressions that we wish to see, specifically like in the NDP6. And I mean, specifically such particular books and such particular themes help to answer certain particular questions as you move on and as you think about the greater world out there. There's obviously also, we actually bump into Charlotte Bronte. And I just spoke about a book that tries to follow or tries to, you know, set the scene in a Charlotte Bronte-ish scenario, which is that The White Sargasso Sea title. Now, Jane Eyre or Jane Eyre or whichever, you know, pronunciation you wish to go for, written by Charlotte Bronte, came out firstly in 1847. It is similar to that Anna Karenina story that I told you about, because Jane Eyre is one about, if I can call it like, you know, just risky business. I'll use that phrase, risky business, but it's not a love story per se. It's just risky business. Just think of that term and how
far that term can take you in thinking of risky business. But this is obviously based upon a scenario in terms of how Jane Eyre has overcome a traumatic childhood, only to be challenged by secrets, strange noises, and obviously mysterious fires in a new home at Thornfield Hall. And this is obviously also as she is falling in love with her employer, which is Mr. Rochester. And it's a pretty dark story. When I say it's a pretty dark story, you know, the setting even, I mean, I've even watched the TV series based upon the thing, and it is, it's not depressing, but it has a very somber look to it. There's another TV series that I also watched that there's a whole bunch that have a somber look to it. Most of the crime drama TV series that I've watched have a lot of somber, you know, they just have this overall somber feeling. But it actually makes you focus in on the story, and you're even captured and captivated by the storyline and the characters and the actors and the, yeah, you know, if the whole mix, if the presentation is done properly and well, just like in many books, you'll be captured and captivated just like what I experience also most times. So yeah, Charlotte Bronte, is obviously also a fan favorite, specifically mostly for female readers. I'm sorry to single you guys out in terms of the Jane Austen and the Charlotte Bronte, but in many cases, I have observed that many ladies, you know, some, when you guys go to classical reads, you guys pick up mostly, you know, those two classical authors. In another scenario, obviously, what is also, just before we actually end the day, is actually looking at a Russian author, which is actually one of the sort of like classical authors to look at when you're trying to look at literally school of hard knocks, tough living, rough stuff, someone living a really hard and tough life, is this book by the classical heavyweight Russian author Fyodor Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment. Now, I haven't read the book myself. I actually want to buy the book, but I've heard from someone that's read the book. If you want to read what tough living is, even though you would be probably living a tough life here in Namibia, wherever you find yourself, but if you want to read it, Crime and Punishment is something that you want to read. It's Crime and Punishment, and there's another one that Dostoevsky also wrote. There's actually two titles, but Crime and Punishment is a book about captivating the depiction of a man that experiences a profound mental unraveling. And specifically, according to what is contained in the book, it's a question of, you know, the kind of life that the main character is busy experiencing, the questions he asks himself specifically from a philosophic perspective, and where things are actually, you know, leading to. Even though the literature that I've got here in front of me says it's a brilliant read if you loved Breaking Bad, I'm like, Breaking Bad? Breaking Bad is a guy that had cancer. He's a chemist, and he decides to become, you know, America's biggest drug dealer by producing a negative product. I mean, how do you equate that to Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment scenario? Even though Crime and Punishment literally speaks about whether or not the character is making that philosophic, having that philosophic argument about whether or not he should literally commit a negative act. In Breaking Bad, the guy was suffering in a terminal illness, something incurable. There is no ethical question. The leap that is made in that particular TV presentation is one based upon the guy decides, you know what, let me go. And someone convinced him, you've got these skills, let's make this, let's make money before you pass away. And then he uses his skills for a negative. So yeah, when you find yourself in a bookstore and you happen to come across this particular book of Crime and Punishment, just know it's heavy. Just know. I've been explained by someone that collected Russian classics before the First World War. Dostoevsky is obviously one of them. There's another guy, I keep forgetting.
But they, and if you read the, there's another one, yeah, but it's set in the Napoleonic War. Is it Love and War? Or is it Peace and War? War and Peace, yeah, that's the book's name, War and Peace. But it's set during the Napoleonic War, even though Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky came out in 1866. Apparently the Russian classics are very good at making you see the life that you probably have been living in Namibia being resembled 200 years ago in a book written very well. Specifically if you're in a developing world or if you're in a developing country world, setting. The Russian classics are very good at telling that particular story. So, yeah. I'm just giving you a heads up. Specifically, if you bump into a Russian classic, just know, yeah, you'll be living that book, or you might have lived that book at one specific point in your lifetime, probably. And just before we actually end off on today's particular segment, dear listeners, we're about a minute out from the top of the hour. There is one particular book, if you like survival stories, 1903, written by Jack London. Okay, the book is not 1903. The title of the book is known as The Call of the Wild. I've watched The Call of the Wild as a cartoon, read and heard the story so many times, but it's technically about, you know, just one of these weird guys that decide to go off into the bush. And then they get stuck there. Wolves start chasing them. They decide for some reason to go live in extreme conditions. And then now you have to look at the story or read a story about some guy trying to overcome nature. I've never heard of people overcoming nature. Guys, to be honest with you, I've never heard of someone overcoming nature. The thing with nature is a do or die situation. It's either you anticipate situations or you prepare for it, or you are the headline news feature Monday morning for, you know, just doing some of the dumbest acts ever. But on that particular note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end for today's segment here of the Holiday Reads on your number one talk radio station. There were so many titles though that we did not explore and did not share, but you will always be able to, you know, if you go to your favorite bookshop, wherever it is across the country, just ask the people, you know what are your classical titles? What do you have on offer? Have a talk to the shop attendants and assistants. Ask them what's up and ask them, you know, specifically what they can recommend as the best read. Whether you're male or female, man or woman, always talk, always engage. And on that particular note, dear listeners, let's see each other again next week, Monday, on the same time, same place, here on your number one talk radio station. This is the Holiday Reads here on Eagle FM. You can catch me on Sunday morning, alternatively, for my Sunday morning take. We'll obviously be exploring everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between. On that note, enjoy the rest of your programming in our company.